Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. He is Chicago's own. So this all began, I believe, this will be a national thing soon. Dr. Jeff Bloomberg, who is the founder of Veterinary Diagnostic Centers. Good morning, doctor. How are you?
Good. Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, you know, it's a pleasure. You've discovered a niche. And that was first with your Irving Park Road location in the city. And now you have additional locations, and we'll give those addresses. But I want to talk about that niche, the idea that you are doing imaging for people that is otherwise kind of hard to come by. Explain what veterinary diagnostic centers are.
Okay. Thanks, Steve. So in our essence, we use telemedicine to connect pet owners with veterinary specialists. It's been very, very difficult for pet owners of in recent years to get appointments with cardiologists and internists and radiologists. And when people need ultrasounds and advanced diagnostics for their pets, they're really having trouble getting it. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to increase access to specialist guidance using technology, using telemedicine. So last year, we opened up our first office, as you said, on Irving Park Road in Chicago. We you know, 90% of what we do are ultrasounds that people cannot get into the specialty centers to get done in a timely fashion.
All right. So give me an example of what an ultrasound, because people may not know until you need it, what an ultrasound might be used for a pet.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we generally do two types of ultrasounds. We do abdominal ultrasounds and cardiac. Our most common abdominal ultrasounds are really presentations for chronic vomiting, you know, acute vomiting. Maybe a pet goes into their vet, even for routine lab work, that they're not even acting sick, and we find liver values are quite elevated. Maybe they're urinating blood. Maybe they're having abdominal pain, and nobody can figure out why. So there's a number of reasons that people would come to us to have an abdominal ultrasound performed on their pets. You know, it just gives you more detail than radiographs. It gives you a lot more of the intricacies and being able to see the inside of the organs instead of just the shape and size of them on an x-ray.
Right. And that's what you refer to as radiographs are x-rays. And I want to talk about cardiac as well. So in cats, feline hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, that's a long, scary word, but, or a series of words, surprisingly common, incredibly common in cats, and the real only gold standard for diagnosing that is a cardiac ultrasound. But dogs also, particularly older dogs or certain breeds, can suffer from a different kind of heart disease, and the only way to truly diagnose that before it gets so bad that the dog or cat is on death's door. And in the case of cats, it's the number one cause of sudden death. You don't want to get to that point. So a cardiac ultrasound, as I understand it, is the only way to really truly diagnose this.
That's exactly right. In fact, already today, I diagnose a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy in a cat. You know, this is a genetic disease generally, and as you said, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy sounds like a big fancy term, but it literally just means thickening of heart muscle. And so there's a condition that we see in cats that really can, as you said, cause acute death. It can have them throw like embolisms and blood clots and things like that. So a lot of times if a feline patient's veterinarian hears a heart murmur, which is basically just turbulence of blood flow in the heart, that's all a heart murmur means, they say you need to go get an ultrasound done of that heart so we can figure out why we're hearing this turbulence. What about the structure of the heart has changed? And you're right, the ultrasound is the best way to figure that out.
So very commonly today, the pet goes into the veterinarian. Now, there are a small handful of veterinary clinics, private clinics, that do offer ultrasounds, and they have experts at that clinic reading. But for the most part, that is not the case. Your veterinarian does not have that kind of equipment. So tells you then, okay, you can contact the an emergency facility near you. They may have it, or this facility or that facility. And you call And you can get in 3 months or so, but that's the problem, isn't it? And right. I suspect why you came along in the first place.
It's true. Actually, it was, you know, I was a primary care veterinarian for 2 decades, and over and over and over, I would hear my patients and their families saying, you know, I called the cardiologist. It's going to be 8 weeks before I can get my pet in there. And it was just a constant story. And if people really needed care, what they ended up doing was what we call going in back door into the specialty centers. They would present through the emergency room because they couldn't get just a regular appointment. They'd get admitted to the hospital through the emergency room and then get transferred to the appropriate service that they had been trying to get an appointment for. The problem with that approach is that they end up getting charged, I mean, literally somewhere between $500 to $1,000 of emergency room fees to basically skip the line and get their pet in the door to see that internist, radiologist, or cardiologist. And it was just very upsetting to see and to hear. And I said, there's just got to be a better way to do this for people.
And actually, the cost you present is even higher because emergency room facilities, right, wrong, or otherwise, charge more than, say, what you charge, you know? So there's that additional fee that you point out. But there's one other thing, too. It jams the emergency rooms. So people that have true emergencies can't necessarily get in as quickly, if at all, in some cases, for hours and hours and hours and hours because they're packed with a variety of people who truly don't need to be there, which has happened in human health and now begun to happen in animal health.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're seeing that a lot. We're seeing, you know, if people are having trouble picturing kind of what we are, I tell people that, you know, everyone's seen an MRI center in a strip mall where your human doctor would send you for an MRI. We're the same thing. We're veterinary ultrasound. So you don't have to go into the big chaotic specialty center to have these types of services done. You can go to a place like ours that specializes in that particular veterinary service that you need. And you can really avoid the chaos and that waiting room of all the barking dogs. And it's, you know, it's intimidating. The pets get upset. And so it's one of the things that we wanted to fix.
Well, the pets get upset, but also the people get upset when they get the bill, and yours isn't as much, and for reasons we described. I want to talk more about the pets not getting upset, which is the way we want to go, and it's your focus as well, being fear-free, and we will talk about that when we come back with Dr. Jeff Bloomberg. Dr. Jeff Bloomberg is the founder of Veterinary Diagnostic Centers in Chicago, and now in the suburbs. How many locations do you have, Dr. Bloomberg?
So right now we are operating 3 locations in the Chicagoland area. We have our pilot primary location on Irving Park Road in Chicago, near Irving Park and Kedzie. We had people driving up from the southwest suburbs all the way up to get to us. So we have opened up a location in Mokena, Illinois. We are actually working out of the animal emergency of Mokena space while they are closed during the day. It's been a wonderful partnership because, you know, they're an overnight emergency service. They open up at 7 p.m. And so we run our ultrasound service out of their facility during the day. And then our 3rd location, we're doing the same thing at the Animal Urgent Care in Crown Point, Indiana. We're using their space during the day while it's dormant. And it's been very well received by those communities, especially in Crown Point, Indiana. They have nobody in northwestern Indiana that can provide these services other than Purdue University, which is about 2 hours away from where we are in Crown Point. So it's been very well received filling this void.
Well, it is a void, and it's a sort of a desert out there, if you will, for this particular sort of technology, which is not exactly anymore cutting edge. It is what is appropriate care. However, there's 2 issues. And one we touched on, and that's affordability. And it's not that you're completely inexpensive, but compared to going to a veterinary emergency center, as for reasons we pointed out, that is going to cost more money. But it's also a matter of simply getting in, which is a problem elsewhere. And it's been a problem in medicine, human medicine and veterinary medicine. So if you want to see a specialist in human medicine, I don't know, a neurologist, a specialist, I'm trying to think of other specialists, a nephrologist, it can take several months. But veterinary medicine has always been ahead of the game in that matter. We're accustomed, those of us that are pet parents, for not waiting quite as long or nearly as long. And now there's a wait, isn't there?
Yes. That is one of the big problems. I mean, you're right about the cardiology where you said, I think right now we're booking out for November in Chicago to try to see a cardiologist. Like I said, in Northwest Indiana, there isn't even a cardiologist available. You have to, you know, drive a couple of hours to go somewhere. So yes, availability has been really rough, especially with the specialists. I mean, primary care vets, it's hard enough to get into your primary care vet these days. The specialists are even worse, and we've got some studies done in our profession that say that by 2030, we're going to be at a critical level of veterinary shortage. So our profession needs to come up with some ideas on how we can provide services to these pets under these conditions. And so I felt that this was a wonderful thing to be able to do, because we use a sonographer, you know, to take the images. We're not relying on a veterinarian to take the images. And then, you know, a veterinarian specialist, you know, interprets everything, but they're not there on site taking the images. And it has absolutely expedited care for so many patients.
All right. So let's talk about what happens. So a pet comes in, a dog or a cat. And first of all, I happen to know for a fact the way in which they are treated is with TLC, you know, you're fear-free certified. And I want to talk about what that means and the difference in the way. And if it sounds like a commercial, that's the way it goes. Because pets, I don't care, because pets need to be treated, I think, a certain way. And, you know, no one's telling the cat this is going to be a good thing for you when the cat needs an ultrasound abdominal or a cardiac ultrasound. So tell me about the procedure for dogs that are fearful or for cats, or to prevent them from being all that fearful.
Yeah. So we take so many measures to try to reduce the stress for both the pet and the pet owner. But, you know, for the pet, you had already, you know, mentioned that our team is fear-free certified. So for those people who are not in the veterinary profession, this is a certification that veterinary professionals can get that helps us learn how to reduce the stress on pets as they come into the hospital. Everything from pre-visit medications like sedatives, teaching pet owners how to transport the pet, which makes it easier, using, you know, pheromones and other environmental factors to reduce the stress on them, how to read their body language and how to respond before they get really wound up, how to recognize those signs of anxiety. Fear-free certification has just been wonderful for us in helping these pets that are so nervous coming in. So that's one of the big things we do. One of the other things we do is we only see one patient at a time. Again, we don't come into a chaotic waiting room. We are focused on you and your pet when you come in. And maybe the biggest factor for these pets in reducing stress is we allow the pet owner to stay with the pet at all times. They do not get separated. I mean, they are petting their pet's head as we're doing the scan, talking to them, comforting them. And I mean, that makes all the difference in the world to these pets who have their families with them.
Well, I want to talk about that, because you take the pet into many clinics and the veterinarian or technician or both do what they do and then say, I need to go to the back to do whatever it is.
Right.
To take the blood pressure for the cat or whatever. And that's horrifying to hear from a pet parent. And then the pet parent hears barking. Is that my dog? Is that my dog? Is that my dog? Eliminating that studies have shown pet parents are more relaxed, and studies have also shown that if pet parents are more relaxed, the pet's going to be more relaxed. And if the pet's more relaxed, the person doing the work, the technician or veterinarian, will be more relaxed. But the opposite is true, too, that tension, fear, anxiety, and stress are also contagious. Can you talk about that?
Yes, we often do see pet owner, you're exactly right, that the pets read the pet owners. And so if the pet owners are nervous, if they're not relaxed, the pets know that something's up. And certainly when you tell people that you are going to separate them from their pets, the people get nervous, and thus the pets get nervous. And so as a veterinary professional, I must say, you do need to read the situation. I mean, some pets are better behaved for what you're trying to do. I mean, taking a blood draw on a dog or cat is not an easy thing. And so sometimes it is best if the pet owner is present, but also there's times when it's best that they're not present. And it's important for the veterinary professional to read these situations and to know what's going to be least stressful for the pet.
Because I want to interrupt you for a second, because a story comes to mind. Then we're going to take a break, and on the other side, we'll continue talking about this. And that story is this, that the veterinarian said, "Are you okay with me doing the blood draw here?" Which is the right thing to do and say. And the owner said, "Of course, I'm fine with it." And quickly did the blood draw, no issue with the pet, and looked over, and the owner was on the floor, fainted. So, because the owner was afraid of blood, I guess. I don't really know. So, yes, you never know what can happen. We'll talk with Dr. Jeff Bloomberg more about what he does and the veterinary diagnostic centers located around Chicago now when we come back. I have no idea why this is the case. Neither, apparently, does the CDC, but they've issued a warning. Warning, warning. They really have it serious that there is more parvovirus in humans. Now, I did not know. I know about dogs and cats getting parvovirus, but I had no idea that it occurs in people. And in fact, it does. And there's more of it than ever before. The CDC doesn't know why that's the case. Parvovirus in humans is spread differently via airborne droplets when an infected person coughs or sneezes, kind of like the common cold, or through blood contaminated products. However, in dogs and cats, it's spread differently. In dogs and cats, it's the infected animal spreads it through its feces that a generally puppy or kitten will step in, then groom itself, and now the puppy or kitten has parvovirus. Now, in parvovirus in dogs and cats, it's usually young animals, as it is young people very often. However, it is often fatal in our dogs and cats. Now, here's the reason why I bring it up. The CDC wants me to make a point of saying that if your dog or cat has parvovirus, you're not going to get it. And if you have parvovirus, you're not going to give it to your dog and cat. That's the good news. This is Dr. Jeff Bloomberg. He is the founder of Veterinary Diagnostic Centers. And we were talking about the importance of cutting fear, anxiety, and stress, both for pets and pet parents, because we're talking about also how if your pets read people so incredibly well. We read our pets not as well, but it is contagious, that fear, anxiety, and stress, and even can lead to the veterinarian then becoming stressful if everyone else in the room is stressed out, I think, Dr. Bloomberg.
Yes. Yes, that's true. You know, we see one of the things that we try to do to reduce that pet owner stress is be very transparent and really live up to expectations. So they know exactly what to expect when they walk in that door, the whole process from that first phone call to where they're checking out and then us getting them the report even within 24 hours. It's critical that everything's transparent and that you create expectations and live up to them. And when the pet owner sees that happening, when they know what to expect, their anxiety level is down and thus the pet's anxiety is down as well. So that's a very important factor that we pay attention to.
We mentioned Fear Free a couple of times. To learn more about it, fearfreehappyhomes.com. It's an initiative that began in veterinary medicine, but right now, not only are veterinary professionals' entire practices, in some cases, certified as fear-free, so are dog trainers, dog groomers. I mean, it's spread all around because it is such an incredibly good idea. I think Not too far away, we'll see zoos certified. Veterinary schools, each and every one, teaches fear-free now. So it is an enormously important concept that you live by. But I also suggest that you might be older than you really are, Dr. Bloomberg. I mean, in some ways, is your goal to be a throwback to when veterinary medicine was, in some cases anyway, more personal?
Very much so. I mean, that to me is so much the enjoyable part of practicing medicine is building the relationships with people and taking the time and listening to them and understanding them and then, you know, educating them. You know, I always joke that I'm not short on opinions, and you know, you get the opportunity to really, you know, teach these people, you know, what's best for their pet, and it's incredibly rewarding. And my son was just talking about going to medicine. He's in high school, and I said, you know, this is a lifestyle choice. It's not a career choice when you go into medicine. I mean, you have to dedicate, whether your patients are human or animal, you really need to be dedicated if that's the profession you choose to go into.
Do you think it's easier to be or going into medical school now to be a physician or going into veterinary school to be a veterinarian?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I think that they have made the veterinary craft a little bit easier than it used to be. When I graduated 20 some odd years ago, we had to learn every species. We didn't have choices, you know, even though I knew I wasn't going to end up working on cows and sheep and pigs and things like that. I had to spend a lot of my education learning those species. Now the vet students are able to track which species they really want to learn so they can really come out of school more focused. And I think that has made school a lot easier on the veterinary students being able to focus on the species that they believe they're going to be working with once they get out into practice.
It's still very hard to get into veterinary school, harder than medical school, in part because there are so many more medical schools than there are veterinary schools. But that's changing. There are more veterinary schools opening up. But meanwhile, you mention, and it's true, that by 2030, and in one of my talks that I give at conferences, Dr. Bloomberg, I have the exact data. I just don't remember off the top of my head. But by 2030, we are going to have, in essence, a ginormous number of pets. I wish I could remember the number in America. But right now, even, we have more pets than we do children in this country. The number of pets continues to go up every year. It's a choice people make for a reason. No one forces people to have a pet or pets. They want to do that. They are doing that. But with a decline in veterinarians post-pandemic because of, for many other professions, same thing, that I don't want to do this anymore just because a number of reasons. In addition to that, it turns out that around the pandemic and post-pandemic, a lot of veterinary professionals retired. It just hit a certain age, and they said, okay, I'm 65 or even older, and I just don't want to do this anymore. So that decline, combined with not enough coming in compared to the number of pet owners coming in, has made it very difficult to find a veterinarian to see on a prompt basis if you need to.
Now you hit it right on the head. You know, it's the perfect storm. You've got a lot of people who are going to retire in a few years, retire immediately when COVID hit and said, I don't need to do this during COVID. We're seeing also in our profession that veterinarians are having shorter careers in terms of the length of their career. They're just in general retiring early, and that's not even the last few years that we've seen that. So we are definitely hitting a critical mass, and our profession is really working hard at trying to preempt some of the problems that we foresee coming and that we're already dealing with to some degree. So we're trying to figure out how to get, you know, the bigger class sizes in the vet schools to draw veterinarians from more diverse communities. And then what I'm doing, which is using support staff to the highest level of their credentials and abilities to provide veterinary services without a veterinarian being directly present.
Which is
I think that's a big one.
Yes, I would congratulate you for that. And also so incredibly important. Is there a website people can go to learn more about veterinary diagnostic centers? We mentioned where they are, but it's hard to catch all that on the radio. What's the website?
It is www.vdc, like Veterinary Diagnostic Center. So it's www.vdc.vet, V-E-T.
And do you just call and make that appointment, or do you need a referral from your veterinarian? How does that work?
Great question. So you can call us, or you can even go on that website and book an appointment. Once you've booked the appointment with us, we then reach out to your veterinarian and coordinate the records exchange and just make sure that everyone's on the same page about what this pet needs, and we coordinate all that.
So to be clear, your mission is not to take over as primary care physician. It is just to do some diagnostic testing, and the results of that communicate to your primary care veterinarian.
That's exactly right. So most veterinarians cannot do their own ultrasounds and cardiac cases, but they can handle the follow-up. I mean, they can take the information from the specialist and then carry out those recommendations. So the primary care vets really like that they get to retain control of these cases instead of sending them to the specialty hospitals. That's a big factor.
It is. Dr. Bloomberg, again, congratulations. You're filling a void, which I clearly believe, let me rephrase that, I know is really very important. And thank you very much for your time.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you, Steve.
Here they are, the top cats in America, according to the Cat Fanciers Association. So just as Scottish Terriers have their own individual personalities in general, Golden Retrievers in general have their own personalities, or Border Collies, the same is true among cat breeds. So not only do they have a distinctive look, clearly, for each breed I'm about to rattle off, but each one has their own personality, and I'll talk about each a little bit. At number 15 on this list is the Bengal cat. Now, the Bengal, at one point in time, was far more popular, and I'm glad that they've slipped a little bit on the list, because they're a difficult cat for many. If you want a cat that just hangs around, that's not your cat. They are highly energetic, kind of like a border collie of the cat world. They always need to be doing something. And if you don't give them something to do that is appropriate, they will find things to do that you might find inappropriate. For instance, I have a video of a Bengal cat going over to the toilet, flushing the toilet, and then flushing the toilet, and watching it, and flushing the toilet, watching it, flushing and flushing, and the water bill these people must have had, you know. You have to give these cats things to do. Or, better, I said cats, more than one Bengal cat living with another. In fact, these cats are quite social, more so than some other cats with other cats. Number 14 on the list, the Oriental. They are lengthy and elegant in a way that can only be described as statuesque. They really are. They retain many of the characteristics of the Siamese cat they were originally bred from, but they come in many other coat and color patterns than, say, the Siamese cat. They're also very vocal cats, like the Siamese cat. The Oriental cat, at number 14, is longer, way longer than they are wider. Kind of the dachshund of the cat world, but not really quite. They're beautiful cats. Number 13 is a big one, and I say that because they're big cats. They're Norwegian forest cat. The what? They're kind of like Maine Coon cats, sort of, in the way that they look, if you're more familiar with the Maine Coon cat. These cats are generally very, very friendly cat, but they're also still cats, clearly. So given the opportunity, and I'm not saying you should give them the opportunity, outdoors they will hunt. Not surprisingly, well, number 13 in America, they're number one in Norway. Number 12 on the list is the Russian Blue. These cats are just beautiful cats with a shimmery silver to steel blue gray coat. They've got green eyes typically, or gray-green eyes. They're beautiful cats. They're low shedding. However, they're not exactly outgoing cats. So if you want a cat that's just hanging around, that wants to be attached to you, but not every visitor you have in the house, that's a good choice. But if you want an outgoing cat that's friendly to everybody, not that they're they kind of are unfriendly. They're more aloof than many of the other breeds I'm talking about. That's the Russian Blue. Number 11 is the American Shorthair. It's long been a hit for its friendly, laid-back vibes. These cats, while friendly, are low maintenance. They come in a bunch of colors and patterns. Sounds like a car, right? You can get them in many colors or patterns. They're playful, but they also know how to chill out. Number 10 on the list, Mr. Bigglesworth. That's the Sphinx cat. That is a cat with no hair, or better put, I think I need to do something politically correct here, right? Follically impaired. That would be the right way to say it. They are wonderful cats. They're big cats, surprisingly. They're muscular cats, more so than you might think. They love to ride on people's shoulders. They love to be with people. Obviously, you don't have to worry about brushing the coat. That's not a problem. But the problem is they can leave spots around the house because some people put coats on them all the time because their oils are not taken in by a coat, which they simply don't have. They are very friendly cats. Number 9, the Siberian. This cat has long, luxurious hair and or fur. And is it hair or fur? And some say they are hypoallergenic. I don't believe that's true, however. They're mellow felines, and they make for wonderful pets for kids, actually. Number 8 on the list, the Scottish Fold. Now, the Scottish Fold last year or the year before was number 20 on the list. Why have they gained so much ground? Two words, Taylor Swift. She has been spotted with her own Scottish Fold. They're named for their folded ears. They're adorable. There's no question about that. They have expressive eyes and rounded faces, and they look like kind of like a barn owl, I think. That's number 8. Number 7, another very busy cat, the Abyssinian. Very, very active cats. They have what's called a ticked coat. So when you pet them, you can see different colors show on their coats, which is really kind of interesting. Number 6, the British Shorthair. That's named for the famous Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland. The British Shorthair has these chubby cheeks, and people like chubby cheeks. We've bred them to have chubby cheeks. Number 5, the Devon Rex. They've kind of got a pixie look about them. They're really outgoing cats. If you put on your makeup in the morning and look into the mirror, you might have a cat on your shoulder giving you instructions about how to put on your makeup. That's the Devon Rex cat. They're entertaining. They're active cats, but not too active. Number 4 is the Exotic. The Exotic is the short-haired version of a very popular cat next on the list called a Persian. Persians are number 3. Persians are, well, a lazy man's cat, they're often called, because they don't do much. The same for the Exotic. The Exotic, you don't have to brush that cat constantly. The Persian needs care for its coat. And they know how beautiful they are, I believe. Number 2, yeah, that's right. We're at number 2 is the Maine Coon cat. Made in America, the all-American cat. They're called the Gentle Giants because they're really big cats, but they're really gentle. They're great with kids and generally good with other pets as well. And number 1 is the Ragdoll cat. This cat is named because when in your lap, they kind of flop over like a rag doll. They do. They come in various colors. They have a coat that does need brushing frequently, and they have that striking appearance with blue eyes, and they have that silky, semi-long fur to complement their large, cuddly size. And in fact, they are cuddly cats. To learn more about this and to read other stories about pets, what do? You go to my website. That's Steve Dale. radiographs.tv. And by the way, I have a newsletter that comes out every couple of weeks. It's absolutely free. You can sign up for that newsletter at stevedale.tv. Oh, one more thing. You could check out other shows we've done. So if you've missed some of the pet shows, simply go to WGNradio.com and you can listen to those through the website. Do you have a bearded dragon lizard? Well, the United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention is worried about you because salmonella has been happening more frequently for whatever the reason among not only bearded dragon lizards, but really all pet reptiles can spread salmonella. So whether you have a red-eared slider turtle or a snake of some kind even, or another kind of lizard, as there are many kinds of lizards, the CDC says always wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water right after touching or feeding a pet reptile. Make sure the children under 5 years of age have done the same thing and have washed their hands, or better, maybe not even have people most susceptible. Just look at that bearded dragon lizard and not touch them. We're talking about very young kids, and we're also talking about very older people. And as much as you love your pet lizard, don't kiss your lizard. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.